Welcome to this edition of When the Biomass Hits the Wind Turbine, a discussion of sustainable living and what that means to you and me. I'm Jay Warmke.
And I'm Annie Warmke.
And today we're going to talk about food production and storage, or does this look okay to you? This is a constant, right, in our house.
Already?
Does it smell funny? All right.
Oh, I didn't know that's what
okay,
you meant.
Okay, we're still
by
talking
that.
About food. So
yeah.
All right.
We were talking about you.
So if we're talking about food production and storage, obviously the heart of sustainability has to do with eating.
Wait, let's go back and talk about if you say, does this look okay to you?
All right. Does it?
Because we have all grown up in a society that is terrified of bugs, whether they're visible, but especially if they're invisible. And so we don't even know what that means anymore. We don't understand mold or fungus. And so at our house, you would, if you were an outsider coming in and you didn't really eat the way we do, you probably would ask that question periodically.
I do ask that question periodically.
you live there.
The cheese in the refrigerator. I said, is this mold supposed to be here or is this something that's just a science experiment
right
now?
So one of the things we just did that was pretty exciting that answers your question of does this look all right to you is we recently had an intern who was born in China. And we were talking about cheeses and how they work. And she is vegan, which means she doesn't eat any animal products. So we were talking about tofu. And I had just realized that tofu is processed just like you would cheese curd. So you drain the whey. And so she started telling me about stinky cheese. And I said, wow, what is that? And so it turns out that it's just exactly the same process as when I put the cheese curd in the little glass containers in the refrigerator, which we call cheese caves. And I made some stinky cheese, and I haven't tried it out yet, but I'm excited about it because I also am vegan, and I wanted to see what it would be like to actually have some other kinds of cheeses.
Well, we always, as a kid, called stinky cheese like the little cans of Parmesan that apparently are mostly sawdust at this point.
But that's exactly the point, the difference between real food and really great bacteria that you're putting into your body and the difference between the stuff that you tend to put into your body, mm-hmm. which is not real food.
Hey, if it doesn't have a label and it comes multicolored, it's not food, you know? So you're talking about real food, like things that come out of the ground and out of the garden. And one of the problems, not a problem, but a challenge that people have, if they are producing and trying to eat their own food, is it's all good and fine when you're harvesting it. You get fresh tomatoes, you get fresh corn, you get things like that. But you have to can, freeze, blanch, ferment, dry this food if it's going to be used or kept over the wintertime. So why don't you touch on some of that? Because you're the expert on this and I am not.
That's true. I'm glad we've established that right mm-hmm. off. So one of the things that is important in terms of when I'm thinking about how I'm going to store food is, first of all, I like to have raw food. And that way I have something that can be can produce a lot of different products. So, for example, I wouldn't make jellies or jams right off in the summer. I would freeze those fruits so that I have them for a variety of things and not just for making jam or jelly. And then when I need jam or jelly, I have what I need. But the other piece of it is that it isn't just about producing food for the winter. It's really producing food for 365 days from that moment. So when I'm putting blueberries in the freezer, when we bring blueberries home or we have produced blueberries on our farm, the five blueberries that we did get.
Yes, that aren't eaten as the interns are harvesting
that's
them.
That's right. Making you jealous, like, wait, I want to have a bite. Anyway, is that I try to think about it as the next time I'm going to have blueberries that I can actually put in the freezer that are locally produced and have all the good vitamins and minerals that I want in them is really almost 365 days from that moment. So how many do I need to put up in order, and put up, I mean, can, freeze, blanch, ferment, or dry before I'm going to be able to have fresh ones the next time. So I'm not thinking about it as a winter activity so that we have food for the winter. I'm thinking of it as a year-long activity. So some things we're going to dry. We have a very nice food dryer. Some things we ferment. So we make different kinds of slaws, which some people would call sauerkraut. We also ferment some drinks in the fall when that's seasonally available, things like cider. And blanching is really not a technique of preserving, although it's part of preserving. So some vegetables you need to dip into hot boiling water and then cold water in order for them to kind of be frozen in time. And if you don't do that and you stick them in the freezer, by the time you want to eat them, it's like eating air. They have lost all their taste. But a lot of things we freeze and a few things we can. So acid foods we can. So tomatoes, we've canned peaches, we've made pickles, we've actually pickled or fermented a number of different kinds of vegetables so that we have them during the time when there aren't that many vegetables available. We might have some greens and things in the winter, but we won't have things like cucumbers and green beans and really delicious things that we could pickle.
Well, why don't you talk a little bit about how you can? Because I was always amazed that the art of canning actually does not involve any cans. That was the first
Or that
shock.
There's art involved in it.
Is there art? I don't know.
There isn't any art, although it's beautiful.
Mm-hmm. Unless art comes over to help.
That's right. But we have nobody by that name, so not yet. Anyway, well, as you call it, the art of canning is pretty simple. It's really creating the ability to put food into a glass container and sealing that in some way so that you're able to eat it whenever you want to. And so that food could last forever if it's sealed properly. Mm-hmm. So,
well, and when you say forever, I mean, that always worries me a bit. I know we were gifted from your aunt several cases of what was it?
Quince jelly.
Yeah. That was labeled like 1964.
It was 72, 1972.
Okay, don't exaggerate. All right. So it was only 20 years old, not 30 years old. And it struck
1972.
Me
as, what year were you born in?
Okay, so it was a time.
It's quite a long time ago.
But the stuff actually, I mean, I assumed that it would be quince/botulism jelly, but it was fine. It was good.
It is still fine. So we're still eating it.
I know we're still eating this.
We don't feed it to guests, though. We're afraid they'll get upset if they find out that it's old enough to be president.
Yeah. So anyway, and probably would do a better job.
That
storage.
Is not probably. Don't get started on that. That's another.
Quince jelly for Congress.
That's right. Okay. No. So just to say canning is really about using hot water in a variety of ways to sterilize containers and things like that, and then also to cook or heat the food that's in the jar. And there's a variety of ways to do it, and there are all kinds of books out there and YouTube videos and everything. I think the best way to learn canning is from someone who's at least as old as me or older, because we're less afraid of the stupidity of the fear of insects and botulism and things like that. And so we're going to show people how to can in a realistic way.
Mm-hmm. So, now, I assume like even the quince jelly would spoil if you set it out on the windowsill in the sunshine and tried to store it for 20 years.
I'm not sure, but it has sugar in it, so it's possible it would draw yeast out of the air and become fermented and then at some point become more like a vinegar. But there are other things if you left out that would do exactly what you said. But I think the jelly wouldn't do that. I think it would be to actually make you drunk.
So, well, okay. There's an advantage.
There's a lot of it still.
So how should you store these things? I mean, storage is going to be – obviously, if you're freezing it, you're going to store it in a freezer.
Right. Well, generally, in using a freezer, we have some really nice Ziploc bags that we use so that – and we try to take all the air out. And some people have we do have a container, a machine that
the vacuum seal.
Vacuum seal.
That never quite actually vacuum seals.
Yeah, so it never worked properly.
It's like one in every six times.
Yeah, or something. But it has worked. And but mainly we just use heavy-duty Ziploc bags, quart bags, snack-size bags, or one-gallon-size bags for the freezer. And then for the canning jars, we use canning jars. And they always say don't use old ones, but we have used ones that are antiques and all as well. So, mm-hmm. And the other thing about storing is that you want to keep everything in a dark, cool place so that things aren't getting too warm. And it should last for as long as until you eat it.
And is this the same if something's fermented? You keep it in a dark, cool space.
Yes, that's very good because it's actively, the fermentation is still actively working. If you want to make it stop fermenting, like with sauerkraut, you're going to put it in a colder environment, like in the refrigerator or a root cellar, so that it doesn't keep fermenting.
Okay, well, if you're new to the idea of canning, jumping back to canning as opposed to fermenting, how would you get started? Where would you get your supplies, that kind of thing?
Well, not just for canning, but any of these things. I mean, they all require a certain amount of equipment. And so most of the things that I use, I've obtained in charity shops or Goodwill or Volunteers of America. So I have some blue granite kettles that have a rack that fit in the bottom. That I paid pennies for really many years ago. I usually go to a bulk store like a Mennonite shop that we have near us and buy bags of lids because I still have plenty of rings. So because the lid comes in two pieces. I've also utilized reusable lids and they work pretty well. But they're expensive, and so I mainly just use those now when I want to keep something in the fridge with a lid like that on it. As far as drying, I think, you know, you can go online and look up food dryers and see which ones rate highly. I like the one we have. It's more of a commercial grade, and it does dry a lot more things at the same time.
Well, a lot of those hunting stores and places like that, Tractor Supply, Rural King, those kind of places have it because a lot of the deer hunters like to dry.
Like jerky things. And things like that.
Yeah. No, they don't call them jerkies, but, you know, they're just hunters. Yeah.
So anything like, you know, we use tongs, and then there's a special tool you can buy just for lifting jars out of hot water, and it costs a couple bucks, and I highly recommend it. It has two yellow handles, and that'll help you a lot when you're dealing with boiling hot water.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, you were mentioning that it's a 365 day a year kind of thing. Almost every product has its own moment when it's ripe and ready to be harvested, and that doesn't always happen in the fall. But if you're not growing a garden, where's the best place for you to get things to can?
Well, before I say that, I want to say that there are plenty of opportunities over the course of a year to continue canning because, for example, when you make soup, which we're from Ohio, so I always think we all eat a lot of soup once the weather's a little cold. And so if you're making homemade soup, which we do quite often during the week, that's a good opportunity to make some extra and then put it in some hot jars and stick it in a hot water bath and can it. So you have fast food for later.
Okay, well, let me interrupt you there to say that you are listening to When the Biomass Hits the Wind Turbine with Jay and Annie Warmke, and reminding you that it is the end of the world as we know it.
And thank God.
Thank God, right. That's the world as we know it needs to be canned, I guess. So we've been talking about canning.
Oh, no, I don't think we want to seal it up
we'll
in
preserve
a bottle.
It
somebody
for later.
Will come along and pull it the lid off.
Preserve
so
it for later.
Before we went to the break, you asked me about where would I buy things, food, to can or preserve in some way if I didn't grow it myself. And so just to say at Blue Rock Station, we don't grow everything that we preserve because there are just some things I'm not able to grow. And also we have several gardens, but some things like cucumbers and squash and things like that take up a lot of space. So I want to keep other farmers in business as well. And so we spend some of our money with other farmers to buy those supplies. We're fortunate in this region to have the Chester Hill Produce Auction. So people can go to the auction during the season, which ends towards the end of October and begins again the 1st of May. to buy fresh produce at a bulk, to buy bulk in bulk or even in smaller lots. So just about anything you can imagine can be bought there for a reasonable price that also benefits the farmer. We also have farmers markets. there are plenty of private farmers that are around that sell small amounts of things when they produce too much. We have several of those in our area. But you can also find things like you can freeze eggs. You can there's a lot of things you can freeze that you don't realize if you have an abundance of them.
Mm-hmm. I know you were freezing milk for a while. You freeze it for the goats, the colostrum for the goats, things like that.
Yeah.
Well, one of the things you're mentioning as far as produce auctions, using your gardens, your neighbors' gardens, farmers' markets, that is sort of brings a key point as far as food, that purchasing food from people you know, people who are near to you, your neighbors, is almost without exception going to be the best alternative rather than going to your local big box grocery store and purchasing food from who knows where. I mean, we like to talk about how every dollar you spent is a vote in support of whomever you're giving that dollar to. So if you do want to see farmers markets continue, local produce auctions continue, or your friends and neighbors continue, you know, vote for them.
Well, you want them to continue to be there producing things that you can't produce.
And if they're nice neighbors, I mean, just to continue.
Right. That's right. So. Well, and for me, it's also a political issue. It's an issue of saying, I want a revolution in this country. And part of that revolution can come if we stop buying and giving our money and buying things from people that we don't really support. And for an example would be that many years ago, when I found out that Kroger's had a policy, an open carry policy for guns, and people were walking into some of these bigger stores and just opening fire because they thought somebody was doing something they didn't like. And it just struck me as absolutely insane that you could go to the grocery store, especially with your children or grandchildren, and think somebody could open fire on you, and that Kroger's did not have the guts to say to their customers, look, leave your gun at home. If Target as a store can say that, then certainly Kroger's could. So I started out by sending a note every week about how much money I had spent. I sent this to the local Kroger's manager saying how much money I had spent at their grocery store. And granted, it was only maybe $300 a month or something, which isn't huge, but it's a lot of money over time. So what I would say is I went to another store and I spent this amount of money, or I went to my local farmer's market and I spent this amount of money, and I kept track of it. And when I got up to about I guess it was maybe $3,000, I decided, well, nobody was going to answer my my concerns. So I started telling everybody who would listen, everybody on tour that came to visit us when we were open, had an open house, anybody who was in my classes.
Anybody listening to this podcast.
That's right. Uh-huh. Don't shop at Kroger's.
All right. Well, that's the word for today. But it's not just Kroger's. I mean, Kroger's has a specific policy that you disagree with, which is,
I don't want to get shot while I'm shopping.
Okay, that seems to be nitpicking, but
well, maybe in your book.
So those cantaloupes can be dangerous. So you
this
gotta
is the
arm
thing,
yourself.
This is the thing that was great about this, besides the fact that I was standing up for what I believed, and that is that I realized that the main things I bought from Kroger's were gallons of olive oil, virgin olive oil, and stale bread. And so I bought stale bread like that they made there on site. And it's, you know, got lots of grains in it and everything. But I was buying it, and then we would make bruschetta or whatever. And so it forced me to find other sources to buy those two things. And it was great because I ended up paying, voting with my dollars at a very small supermarket near us who never ordered gallons of oil, but they ordered 4 gallons at a time. That was how they came. And then since then, I've also bought it at a wonderful international market that I like to support. So it helped me to broaden what I was thinking. And that's the whole point of everything we're really talking about, is you cannot preserve food or dry food or ferment food or do any of this stuff if you don't have a little bit of a basic plan of how it's going to work. And at the end of the day, you're really providing yourself with a lot of fast food by doing this versus going to the store and trying to figure out what's available. You've got good food and it's right there in your own house.
And what you're saying is food is inherently political. And
in my life, it is.
And, I mean, that's right. The zucchini revolution.
Or something like that.
So anyway, so let's move on from politics and talk about...
life is politics,
life,
Jay,
is politics.
Really,
all right. Breathing is a political statement. We're talking about preserving food. Obviously, when food is being harvested, it's abundant. But
Not this year in my garden. But assume that
typically. And so we talk about primarily we think about this over the winter time. So what are some of your menu issues, items, suggestions for using? So you have fresh or canned sort of fresh food year round.
Yeah, it's pretty fresh, and it tastes good because it's coming from a nutrient rich soil. But here's the thing, I like to have menu because it helps me to not have to think too much that day about it because I'm very busy. I run a business. I deal with people all day long, or I deal with critters. Many days have 15-hour day. So I don't really want to put 4 hours into a meal. And we do eat our major meal between 1 and 2 each day. So the main problem, and this is what suggestion I would give to anybody, is if you want to try to do any of the things we're talking about and you want to have a menu, you need to involve everybody who's going to be eating. Because one of the really big burnouts of all of this is trying to always come up with something good to eat. And it takes a certain degree of creativity, the same as in preserving the food, because you want it to look good. Nobody wants to eat food that looks awful or smells awful or tastes awful. And also, you want people to own what you're about to feed or cook, because you want them to participate and like it. So I like menus. I love to make potato soup. It's one of my standbys because you can make it taste different, or you can make it just be delicious with a really good potato with salt and pepper. And every time we do our newsletter, I have a little piece in the newsletter that says something about fast food, because I feel like we haven't learned enough about how to produce fast food in our own kitchens so that we don't mind when we come home and we're tired, that we can still prepare something fit to eat for ourselves, that we feel like, wow, this was delicious and I didn't have to work for 4 hours to get it that way.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things you like to, I was going to say rant about while in the kitchen, is that people don't really cook anymore. They're mostly just heating things up. And,
right.
And what you're getting at is, okay, well, how can you actually cook again?
Well, you can just heat things up. The studies show that Americans love to hate their kitchens. They've got a lot of appliances. They got a lot of stuff that produces food, but they aren't really producing it. But if I make a lot of soup today, say I like to make chili, and I love the taste of chili, especially on a cold day. And I don't put meat in it, but that doesn't matter. You can put anything you want. And then I make a lot of it. Then I can do one of two things with the leftovers besides incorporate it into maybe another day. I'm going to have 2 days from now, we'll have baked potatoes with chili on top of the baked potato. So I'm reusing it in some way. But then I could cool the chili down and put it in Ziploc bags in the freezer and flatten them out so they're easily thawed. Or I could put it in some hot jars and put it in a hot water bath, and I could can it. And any of that creates fast food for my life. So if I have a flat bag in the freezer that's thinned out, I can go in and break off chunks of that because I want to use it on top of something or I just need a little bit for myself because I'm alone that day and I just want something nutritious and tasty for lunch. So again, it all comes back, though, to being clever and creative. And maybe you do something like, if you're a young person especially, get your friends that live in your apartment building, or get your mom and your brother and sister or whatever, and maybe some Sunday once a month you cook up a big batch of something, or you process a lot of food and you put it you know, put chunks of zucchini in the freezer, whatever that is, so that you actually have the ability to go to that just like you would go to the store and look at the shelves and say, what do I want to make?
Well, you do that quite often. I mean, as far as with almost social gatherings of people, either it's canning or processing something you got from the produce auction, and then everyone shares in the harvest.
It's very festive, and people tell stories, and it's fun when you don't know people. It's a great way for people to get to know each other and also to cooperate and help each other. And lots of times when we have young people, we will process food, and I enjoy that tremendously. It makes me super happy.
Well, it sounds like the canning, though, I mean, right off the bat is a way of dealing with some extra food, you know, holding it back for later that might have otherwise spoiled or been thrown away. But so what are some of the ways you deal? I mean, here in America, we have such an abundance of food, and the statistics show some huge percentage, whether it's 20% or 40%.
Yeah, it's a lot of wasting.
Yeah, it gets just thrown away.
Yeah. And well, I'm not very good at wasting things. And so one of the things that I like to do is, again, to have a menu that takes something and repurposes it, reinvents it somewhere else in the menu, maybe a couple of times over the course of a few days. If I have like an abundance of tomatoes and I don't really have time, I'll stick them in the freezer and then I can use them for something else later. But also, I have the good fortune of having a really fantastic compost bin that I never really have to do anything to. It's full of worms. Who knows why? They say you can't do it this way, but it happens. Full of worms. There, I have 3 55-gallon compost bins, and they're full all the time, and full of all kinds of beautiful things that we don't need. But mostly, we've been using our food waste for our chickens, or especially our pigs. Pigs love variety of food and need a variety of food, just like humans. So nothing really goes to waste, because if we aren't using it ourselves or the animals are using it, we're making soil with it.
And the food waste that's still on the plates gets washed by the dogs, who seem to find that an enjoyable pastime.
I know. You like to call it pre-wash. So now nobody is going to come and eat food at our house since we have pre-washers.
Well, what would be practical, though, for someone living in town? They're not going to have pigs. I mean, they might have a dog who
licks
their plate.
Well, they could have vermiculture, which is a worm bin, where they could be creating soil, because a lot of people that live in town are going to start plants in the spring. And worm castings can be mixed with other compost because it's too rich as a soil for a plant. And they could be creating soil for the plants that they want to start in the spring for a garden or whatever.
So in summary, basically, we're using food as a political statement. Buy from people that you know and like as a vote. And don't waste any of this stuff. So anyway, with that summation, you've been listening to When the Biomass Hits the Wind Turbine with Jay and Annie Warmke. Thanks for spending just a little bit of time with us. And as your grandmother probably told you, hopefully told you, the secret to a happy and sustainable life is...
play nice with others, clean up your own mess, and eat those vegetables.
Eat them all year long.
Mother Earth will sing and her children will be
You can find more information on living sustainably in our unsustainable world at BlueRockStation.com.